Hello, my fabulous radio listeners, and welcome to yet another instance of Loveline, also known as Sex Talk. I'm your host, DJ
Porntopia.
And with me in the studio tonight is a frequent guest, the esteemed Dr. Michael Zeiling of the Homosexual Research Institute.
Hello, all my fans.
And our extra special guest, Kurt Saunders, Esquire. Kurt is a lawyer here in the Pittsburgh area and also a frequent lecturer at Duquesne University, where he discusses issues related to internet law. Welcome, Mr. What do we call it? What's the title appropriate for lawyers? Doctor? No.
Lawyer. Counselor.
Counselor Saunders. Counselor Saunders is going to be talking with us tonight about the internet and about obscenity issues and legal issues related to the internet. This is actually a very salient point because we just, our recent market research indicates that I think about 63% of our listeners are preteens and teenagers listening to us on the internet over their computers. That is, our listener base over the internet is much wider than our actual radio coverage. I was fascinated to learn that. This is part of the research you just produced.
That's right. Well, this is more true of all the shows on WRCT, though.
Interesting.
Really.
So
it's really a worldwide audience that we're facing here at WRCT. You know, you'd be surprised at how popular we are in Gambia. It's one of the countries in Africa.
Well, I know because of the email that I get that we do get numerous questions from. Is there a large homosexual population in Gambia?
There's a large homosexual population, which is particularly surprising, is that Gambia is traditionally a French-speaking country, but for some reason they really like us there. I mean, we thought it would get more like listeners from an English-speaking country.
That's definitely fascinating. Maybe we'll get to that a little bit later in the show. I'd like to just announce right away that if there are any caller questions or comments, please, as always, call in at country code 1, area code 412-268-WRCT or 621-WRCT. For those of you who don't have little letters on your phone, that's 1-412-621-9728.
You can also send us email, too, while you're listening to the show. And sometimes we have people come and get it, and we can answer your email questions over the show, too.
Maybe we'll hear from someone in Gambia.
Indeed, could be. So I actually don't know our email address.
Isn't there a Loveline one?
Yes, there is, but I don't know what it is. I don't know. I'll have a producer look that up. I'll get back to you. Let's just get rolling. Time's a-wasting here. Counselor Saunders, so tell us a little bit about the background of the CDA. Some of our listeners might not be familiar with the so-called Communications Decency Act, which was, I believe, proposed, a year ago or so?
Oh, it was actually enacted in 1996. The Communications Decency Act prohibited the electronic transmission and display of quote-unquote obscene and indecent materials using any telecommunications device that was accessible to children. So if you had a computer in your home that wasn't under some type of control, it was potentially subject to regulation under this statute. And children under the age of 18 years of age were governed or subject to this prohibition.
We should mention here, just because it was actually kind of fascinating, that the Carnegie Mellon University had its own part in the CDA being passed by Congress.
How so?
We had a student here who did research for his undergraduate research project. We have them. This program of undergraduate research projects called, I think they're SURGES. I think it's short for Small Undergraduate Research Grant. And one of them looked at accessing pornography on the internet. And his study showed that, everyone on the internet was rapist or something like that, something along this level. And it was used by Senator Exon, who was the Democrat from Nebraska who first proposed the CDA as a reason why we had to, clamp down the internet because, 100% of the users of the internet are rapists or something like this.
So that's interesting.
This was the famous and he published this in a really odd place. He published it in
Georgetown Law Review.
Right, and the paper was called "Marketing Pornography on the Information Superhighway," if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I think so.
I think I've seen that actually. Now that you mention it, yeah.
Well, it wasn't. What was interesting about it is the paper wasn't peer reviewed at all. It was just kind of put there under the assumption that some way it was accurate. It turned out that the paper was, that the premises of the paper were fairly fundamentally flawed, and this was actually found out even before the CDA was passed, and so Senator Exxon suddenly stopped talking about the Carnegie Mellon study.
Well, you know what? Most law reviews and law journals are not peer-reviewed. They're run by law students, so it's usually second and third-year law students who make decisions about what they want to publish or not. So it doesn't surprise me that something like that slipped through. Oh, well.
It was also a little bit of a strange venue to publish something like that, right? Isn't it? I mean, a law... Or is it? A study of the internet like that, does that really belong in a law journal?
Well, I guess if you're trying to say that the laws are... We need laws to clamp down the internet, then it's probably as appropriate a venue as any other place.
I see. So indeed, so... Back to 1996 and the CDA, these senators were trying to protect our children from seeing harmful imagery, or what was the point of this law?
Well, that was basically it. They wanted to prevent children from having access to or seeing what they considered to be obscene and indecent materials using the internet. And what happened was the ACLU and a number of other plaintiffs got together, I think, on the same day that the law took effect and challenged its constitutionality in court. And it wound its way through a federal district court out in Philadelphia. You actually sat in on the argument for that, didn't you?
Yeah, I sat on the argument. There's actually... I guess there were two sets of plaintiffs in Philadelphia. There was the ACLU and its allies, and then there was the American Library Association.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they've some way combined. I don't really know like how these cases get formed together.
I think the cases were joined together, okay. So it was one big case.
It was one big case, and so the American Library Association had its lawyer, and the ACLU had its lawyer, and they were both arguing against the set of lawyers for the government. And I went to one. I was at the trial one of the days when it. I said, "Do you call it trial when it's a case like that? Is this the right word?"
It's probably was more of an argument or a hearing on.
Okay, the hearing. So yeah. I was at the hearing, and the judges. I mean, I guess they were all like either Reagan or Bush appointees, but they were all, you know, very sharp, and they. They all seem to, you know, be asking more or less the right questions. I mean, they seem to be, you know, dealing with the internet very intelligently. I have to say,
why would being Reagan and Bush appointees make a difference there?
Well, it's just that it was. I mean, not Exxon was.
There's an unstated premise there.
Well, yeah, there is an unstated premise, but it's pretty clear that the party that tends to have the senators who want. To censor everything and who don't respect the First Amendment tends to be the Republican Party.
Well, I think I disagree with you on that, but that's a go ahead.
Well, no, you can look at the votes. I mean, there's not really a way to argue because my point here, because you just go look at the votes on, you know, these type of free First Amendment issues. It's Republicans who like things like CDA. It's Republicans pushing for this flag burning amendment. I mean, there's not a lot of room for argument.
Well, but indeed, your point was actually that these judges were especially technically savvy, respective of their opinion about the First Amendment.
Well, I guess my point was that they actually did seem to be concerned about the First Amendment. The First Amendment actually did have some validity in their minds, which a Congress passed in the CDA obviously had, you know, no respect for, you know, people's right to talk, essentially. And so, you know, I don't know how to, maybe I'm, it's been a long time since I've been there, but I just remember thinking, these people are pretty sharp. They're asking good questions. The government lawyers, it was basically government lawyers that were defending CDA. These are people in the Department of Justice. So theoretically, people who Clinton is technically in charge of were the people trying to defend the Communications Decency Act. And I guess they were doing the best that they could given what it was they had to defend. What happened, to give away the plot, the judges in Philadelphia decide 3-0 that the CDA was unconstitutional, and then they'd set it up so that it would then go to the Supreme Court immediately then, and so it was decided 9-0 by the Supreme Court, I think, that the CDA was unconstitutional.
Also filled with Reagan and Bush appointees, as I recall.
Yeah.
Strange how the CDA was signed by a Democratic president, but oh well. I guess he didn't believe in the First Amendment either.
If you look at all the votes against the CDA in the Congress, all the votes in the Senate, every single person who voted against the CDA in the Senate was a Democratic senator.
So why did Clinton sign this thing? Did he just know?
Well,
that
I think
he's running for re-election.
There's actually a good reason why Clinton signed the law, which has nothing to do whatsoever with the CDA. The CDA was not passed all on its own. It was packaged with a huge bill to reform the telecommunication industry, and so in order for him to not pass this bill, he would have had to strike down a bill that had to do with reforming the entire telecommunications industry, and he just couldn't do it.
So this was before the line item veto, which is now gone again, was...
Well, it's not so clear. This wouldn't be a line item veto. This would be a provision in a bill.
Oh, I see.
So even a line item veto won't apply here. So it's basically this huge bill to supposedly deregulate the telecommunication industry.
So how do the courts and how do people view the internet as a medium? Is it in the same class as, you know, books and newspapers and magazines, or we were talking about this a little bit earlier, and we talked about how books appear to have. You can publish a lot of things in a book, and people aren't worried that they are sort of worried that children might get a hold of that book, but they accept that that's the, you know, one of the hazards of living in a free society is that occasionally your child is going to read Playboy or whatever.
Well, actually, before the CDA was enacted and the ACLU versus Reno case was decided, that was the question that was most debated. How should we view the internet? Is it more analogous to print media, books, magazines, or is it more like radio and TV? And depending on which side you came down, that affected the scope or the amount of First Amendment protection that you could give to it. Because usually print media is given very broad First Amendment protection, whereas TV and radio is given much more limited protection because it's the scarcity of the electromagnetic spectrum is considered a public resource that can be regulated. So the question of whether it's more analogous to print or broadcast media came up. What happened in the Reno case was that the court said that the internet was given full First Amendment or entitled full First Amendment protection in that case. And that was very important in terms of regulating or determining how the courts are going to regulate obscenity on the internet.
I think it's also important to understand like why the courts made that decision, because it's basically fairly straightforward logic. It's very easy to understand. The courts decided that the internet was more like publishing books because there wasn't any scarce resource that had to be allocated here, like a radio spectrum.
And the attorneys who argued the case, I think, made a very good case that the internet really was a totally new type of or medium of expression and was sort of open to all kinds of things, much more like print media.
Well, I'm not sure I'm seeing the logical connection between resource scarcity and obscenity. I mean, for example, on this very show, there are words that we can't say and things that we can't talk about. What does that have to do with the scarcity of the spectrum?
It's basically an excuse that has been used to allow the censorship of television and radio.
The airwaves being a public resource. Once you classify them as a public resource, then you can subject them to public regulation.
In some sense, there's more government control and ownership over them. This is actually about this. This is actually pretty similar to what happened in the 19th century in the United States. That a very important government-owned resource was the post office. The post office vastly more important in the 19th century than it is now, and so they were able to attempt to regulate obscenity and information about abortion and birth control by saying you couldn't send it through the mails, through the U.S. mail. This is because the mail is a government-owned resource. The government could basically effectively censor because it was using its own resource as the means of censorship.
Well, so that's interesting. So that's really strange, right? I mean, presumably with the post office, there's no resource scarcity issue. It's more a resource ownership issue.
Right. And I think that the way they were able to do television and radio is because of the scarceness of the resource, the government was still able to have some type of, like, retain some residual property interest in the entire spectrum.
So why is it that cable TV is looser than broadcast TV, for example? You know, the things you can see on HBO that you would never see on NBC.
I think it's still controlled, right?
It's still heavily controlled in many ways.
Right. So what's the difference? Is the difference voluntary? You know, is NBC is adhering to some kind of family value standard just because they think that's what their listeners want, or are the rules looser for cable TV, or what?
I'll take a guess and say that part of the situation with cable TV is that you can subscribe, so that there's a kind of, you know, a commercial transaction there, some type of proprietary interest in that, whereas NBC, CBS, that's all, you know, that's open, really. That's tune in. It's on the public airwaves. I don't know. Do you think that might have something to do with it?
It could just be the you know, they have different law. They've just passed different laws for cable and the regulating broadcast TV at different times, and they just simply reflect that.
Yeah, I'm not that familiar with telecommunications law to say for sure either. But the whole question of how do you regulate obscenity has been around for a long time. There, I don't know if you've ever heard of the famous quote from, I think it was Potter Stewart, a justice on the Supreme Court in the 1960s and 70s, who in a case said, well, I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it. And for a long time, that's how the courts were dealing with it. It was sort of very ad hoc. And then in a case called Miller versus California, the Supreme Court tried to spell out an actual test as to how you can determine if something is obscene or not. They said, you know, step one is, would the average person consider it appeal to only the prurient interest under contemporary community standards? And that's a mouthful right there. You know, what is a prurient interest? It's something that's lewd. It's something that's involves sexual conduct, lustful, whatever.
So, Councilor Sanders, I'm going to interrupt you for just a second because we have a caller.
Oh,
and as always, the callers come first in the show. So, so hello, is the caller there?
Yes. Hi. I noticed that PBS is sometimes more loose with nudity. Did you happen to notice that yourself? And if so, what do you think about that?
I can't say that I've watched PBS recently.
but they do. They always have these fabulous, like I was just watching, what's that 13-part, I, Claudius has this fabulous opening scene with a bunch of naked dancers, and they're all just like jiggling their breasts, and it's totally incredible. Mm-hmm. And right, you'd never see that on NBC.
Yeah.
I think it just shows that, you know, these socialist institutions are trying to bring about the moral decline of America.
But see, that's not obscene, though. You know, I, Claudius is not obscene.
Right, no, I, Claudius was actually fabulous. But,
And then there was a few years ago, there was the controversy with Tales from the City and such.
Right, so how did that get resolved? I mean, and PBS declined to show the sequel, isn't that right? Or did they finally show it?
No, I think Showtime showed it or something.
I think that's right. I think Showtime just showed it.
But I think we actually don't know. Do we actually know the answer to this question? Are the rules different for PBS, or is this just because they're a bunch of liberal?
I think the rules would be the same for PBS.
Yeah, I think what it is that wouldn't be considered obscene because it's the nudity or the sex that was involved was not strictly for, you know, lewd interests. It involved, it had literary or creative or artistic merit.
It's part of a, you know, National Geographic show or something. So do you have a particular show in mind that you're referring to?
Well, no, I was just, I just wondered about it because they get all funny about things on broadcast television, even something like Ellen or whatever, you know what I mean?
Right.
Well, I think it could also have something to do with the difference. It's just the difference between the audiences. That it's to some extent that PBS gets this slightly more highbrow audience that wants, like, you know, more artistic things, and that they actually would kind of delight in seeing, like, nude dancing just despite the, you know, right, the white trash who watches, you know, some TV football game on
okay, right, but I mean, you're conflating the issue. I mean, presumably do they or do they not, are they not bound by the same legal standards?
Oh, yeah, they're bound by the same legal standards.
And so it must be a voluntary decision by the programmers. NBC wouldn't air, you know, Ellen's breasts or whatever, but PBS might because PBS would argue that it has some kind of cultural value. Maybe the Ellen's breast things was bad.
Well, I guess there's another trouble here that... I mean, I almost see that. I mean, pornography has always been so vaguely defined that one could even see that if PBS, you know, showed, you know, started showing pictures of, like, say, Hillary Clinton's breasts because, you know, they found them or something, this would be obscene or something because it's not.
It might be newsworthy.
That's true. That could be newsworthy. That's a bad example. But, you know, that if they had, like, you know, if they started showing like Big Bird's breasts or the, you know, breasts of the woman inside, you know, Big Bird, this could be considered.
Is it a woman inside? Is there a woman screaming to get out of Big Bird?
It's actually a violation of broadcast rules to even suggest that Big Bird is not an autonomous creature. So to the kids listening, Big Bird is what it is, a big bird. It has what do birds have? Birds have little. Birds don't.
They don't have.
Birds don't have breasts.
No. So the point here is, you showed Bert and Ernie's penis. You know, this could be.
Well, for example, if you made explicit the obvious homoeroticism between Ernie and Bert, that would indeed. Well, would PBS ever have the courage to do that? I wonder.
That's a tough one. I don't know.
I mean, it's sort of clear that they've got that, you know. I mean, this has been discussed. They sleep in the same bed, right? They do everything together. You know, Ernie's obviously the passive one, and Bert is the...
But you can never tell. You can never tell by, you know, things like signs like that. People surprise you.
That's so true. All right.
Meanwhile...
So I hope we've answered your question.
Okay.
Did you have additional commentary that we can illuminate?
No, that's all right. Thank you.
Thank you for calling. So if there are other callers that want, you know, stimulating analysis of their questions, please do call in. The numbers, as always, are 268 WRCT and 621 WRCT. Also, Carnegie Mellon's pre-college program is just beginning, and there are a lot of young students on campus. If you want to share your partially formed, immature little thoughts with us, please call in at 621 WRCT.
I'm thinking that we should also offer a contest this year for whoever has sex with the most, whoever in the Carnegie Mellon community who has sex with the most pre-college students. You know, we could like offer some sort of a prize for them.
I'd just like to say that neither I nor the station nor our producer condones this contest. but
the guest.
I don't know. I think that the CDA was on to something in some sense. That under a certain age, I don't want to think of people in a sexual way. I mean,
I disagree. I think that we need to look at human history and see what has happened. In ancient Greece and ancient Rome, you know, there are statues all around of satyrs and having sex with maidens and stuff like this. You know, so this is like, you know, kind of halfway between bestiality and rape and all this. And, you know, I suspect that the, you know, young men grew up just fine in Rome and Greece. And, you know, the women probably didn't because, you know, they were fairly oppressed. But, you know, I don't think it really was any big disaster psychologically for the four-year-old boys to see representations of kind of bestiality and sex at the same time.
So you think that basically parents should take the responsibility for controlling or not controlling what their children do and see on the internet?
I don't think we should worry about it at all. I simply don't think it's an issue. I think that the idea of controlling children at all or really giving a second thought to, you know, what they happen to see like this is just a waste of time. It's a waste of effort. We just shouldn't bother with it.
If I'm a parent and I want to install NetNanny on my computer,
I don't think NetNanny should be installed. I'm opposed to all this.
You would forbid me from doing that?
I think that children have rights, and I think the most fundamental right that children have is the right to access whatever information they want to access.
Could they sue me if I installed NetNanny?
I think that would be a really good way to deal with, you know, parents wanting to be overly controlling of their children, is to prevent the children to see them later on in life, yes.
See, here's the thing that I have this question. I mean, when people talk about children, they talk about, like, what they would be like if they had these, like, grown-up, like, brains inside their children. And is it not true that, you know, 11-year-olds, when they're exposed to influences like, for example, if they learn that, you know, one of their fellow children in say, you know, where did the schools, like, when they hear about school shootings happening somewhere else, you know, or when they see a lot of violent movies, or when they get, there's numerous kinds of influences that children get that actually alter their behavior, and I actually don't think people get grown up enough to process stuff appropriately until they're older.
But why is it that sex is something we have to protect children from? I mean, why? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if you know, children having access to information means that they have two or three more sexual experiences when they're 12 rather than when they're 14.
Right, but you're changing the question.
Who cares?
Okay. No, I mean, I happen to agree with you that sort of appropriate access to sexual information and liberal access to sexual information is fine. I don't think access to, you know, weapons building or, various kinds of violence and cruelty is necessarily something you should give kids free access to because it will warp them.
I don't know.
Looks like we have a call.
Oh, we have a call. Thank goodness. Welcome to the show, caller.
Hi.
Hi.
I am one of the pre-college kids you talked about.
Oh, fantastic. Welcome to Carnegie Mellon.
Thank you.
How are you enjoying your stay so far?
Oh, I think it's great. It's fun.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Anyway, I heard the other caller talk about the whole PBS issue, and I too heard it and also think something about it, which is that while I heard it was before I came here, a couple of weeks before I came, where I just was leaving PBS on, where I was using my computer at like 1:30 in the morning, and they were playing just these college-made videos and stuff, where it was extreme cursing and violence and other stuff. Didn't offend me or anyone else, but I think the point is that as long as people like PBS aren't afraid of being sued, it doesn't matter. And I think regulations stop becoming regulations. I mean, the regulations are just the public wants and what the public will sue for, if that makes any sense.
Well, sort of. I mean, it's certainly true that you know, nobody gets in trouble with the FCC until somebody complains. I guess, is that your point?
Yeah, it's like, a friend of mine works for another college radio station over at Princeton University, and he said that there's no really regulations against cursing on the radio, and this may not be true, but the part is that if the FCC catches you, they can revoke your license, but no one's telling you don't do it. It's just like, don't do it because we won't give you a license. And I think that, to a certain extent, that's wrong.
Isn't that the way a lot of laws operate, though? I mean, you know, take the speed limit, for instance. People are out there speeding even as we speak, and unless they're caught in a speed trap or by a police officer, they get away with it, right?
Same thing's true for murder, ultimately.
Right, I mean, that's true for any law, right? I mean, there's certainly no, you know, psychic god insect that immediately punishes you for breaking the law.
I think what I'm saying is it's just not the FCC doesn't really care all that much. Like if you speed by, maybe the cop won't care. Uh-huh. But if you're going really fast, he's going to pull you over. Yep. And if you're playing a bunch of curses and other stuff on the radio or TV at night, they're not going to stop you.
I'm actually going to ask the opinion of producer Kate, because she's actually responsible for the content of this show. Do you have a comment on this, producer Kate?
Well, I think that just like, you know, getting a ticket when you're speeding or whatever, the consequences for using bad language or what they consider to be the seven deadly words on the radio are just very, very heavy fines for the person that plays and not for the loss of the license of the radio station. But at the same time, I think that someone in the public who actually hears this has to complain to the FCC, because they certainly don't monitor every radio station, every television station, you know, 24 hours a day. And there are certain windows of opportunity for people, considering, you know, nighttime hours, they tend to be more lenient. I think PBS is sort of a special case because PBS, a lot like NPR, considers them to have a sort of elite audience that will probably appreciate any of these sort of gray areas as an expression of art, less than a obscene gesture.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that they have more opportunity because their audience tends to be much more open-minded about things like that. Whereas ABC, NBC, and CBS are something that anybody with an antenna or some bunny ears can pick up and, you know, can think whatever they want to about it.
Right, but then
I saw similar to this. I saw a show on C-SPAN recently. It's like their C-SPAN book channel. So they had an author of a book, and she was like using all sorts of words and talking about her book. And, of course, her audience was, like, you know, very highly educated and thought they had very refined taste. And so they were all quite willing to accept her use of words that, you know, you just couldn't use on NBC at all.
Right. Yeah, but then you get, or for me at least, you get the old issue of who do you define as having this refined taste? How do you say that, you know, me being a kid, you can't prevent me from watching PBS, so why don't you release some of the regulations and let them play culture war programs that are going to hopefully enlighten me?
I think part of the answer to that is laws against pornography have always had a very strong class basis, that if you look at, like, pornography laws in the 19th century, that, you know, something that only the wealthy could have access to was never pornographic. Like, you know, you had, like, books of like, Roman statues that were, you know, pictures of, like, statues of satyrs having sex with maidens. And because, you know, these books would cost, like, $200, and not very many people had $200 back then, you know, that couldn't possibly be considered pornographic. whereupon, you know, that some, you know, penny novel that had, you know, some bad words in it, well, that could be considered pornographic.
And part of what's considered pornography, or at least obscenity under the law, is tied into what the community, what community standards in whatever jurisdiction you're in considers to be obscene. So I'm sure that comes into play here too.
I have a question for the caller. How do you feel about a Communications Decency Act that would prohibit you from, you know, looking at the websites you want to see? Or, and try to think back, like, you know, like, say, when you were 13, which I guess wasn't that long ago for you, you know, would you want your parents to have, like, a net nanny or something like that to protect you from information back then?
Well, I mean, my general view on all this is that I think it's really ridiculous to go ahead and censor all of this stuff. First of all, from a technical point of view, it's pretty much impossible to. I mean, you can install the net nanny, but any kid that's had some experience is going to override it. And, like, I don't even use Windows. I use Unix, and there is no program for Unix. So, I mean, unless you really, really try limiting me, there's no way technically that you can prevent me from doing that, or just sort of grabbing, you know, mom's credit card and, you know, saying I'm 18 and getting all these things anyway, which is the same thing I could have done if I went to a store with, you know, asking them over 21 or 18 to buy me a magazine.
That point was made by the Supreme Court in the ACLU versus Reno case. They said that it's virtually impossible to verify if someone is over the age of 18, even if you're using credit card verification.
And in terms of, I guess, socially, I think that it's wrong as well. I mean, the internet is a developing medium, and I think that people should accept the fact that there might be stuff on there that they don't want children to see, but there's stuff on PBS at 1 o'clock in the morning that children to see. Well, anyway.
So I would just like to make a side point for all of our pre-college listeners listening who might be interested in being a guest on a future issue of Sex Talk. Or if the caller wants to be on a future guest, we're always looking for guests, and we'd be very interested in getting the pre-key point of view on relationships, sex, and sexuality. So if you're interested in potentially being a guest, either call us here at the studio. 8WRCT is the phone number on campus. That's 268WRCT. Or surf to our website, which is, get your little pre-key pencils out, http://, what is it, Loveline, or... excuse me, we have a new name now. It's http://sextalk.wrct.com. You can listen to all of our old shows there in real audio format, and you can also send mail to your fabulous hosts, which would be me, and indicate your interest in being on the show. We are very interested, as Dr. Xylene indicated here, very interested in discussing the pre-key lifestyle. And
not like that, the school administration doesn't want you to come on also.
Oh, that's not true.
Well, my mom's sort of a somewhat famous sex therapist anyway.
Really?
Yeah, so I guess that puts a whole other twist in the whole
story. I didn't mean to make that little noise with my voice. Is your mother's name someone I would recognize?
It depends. Her name is Dr. Sandra Lieblum.
Ooh, that doesn't ring a bell.
It's not famous like Dr. Ruth famous.
Dr. Westheimer?
Excuse me?
No, go ahead. She's
an author. She publishes books, Principles and Practices in Sex Therapy. I mean, more textbook type styles, but within the field of sex therapy, she's pretty well known.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Maybe she could be a guest on your show.
Oh, yeah, maybe we can hook up with your mom through you. But anyway, so I'm serious with the invitation. Please do write or call us or whatever. And
so
did growing up with a mother like that pervert you in any obvious way?
Yeah, I mean, that sort of is the common question. Not at all. I probably knew about things like menopause earlier than anything else in the world.
Is that good or bad, I wonder?
Yeah.
You can imagine just sort of ruining any of the kind of excitement of sex entirely by having someone who's just telling you about it all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, whoa, you know, I have all this stuff. It's more like I was just more educated than I think that a lot of my other friends.
She probably encouraged you to go on the internet, right?
Well, not. I actually sort of went on the internet, and I encouraged her to go on the internet,
oh, wow.
And so she would understand this more.
Does your mom have a website?
No, not yet. It's she wanted me to program a web. I was like, no.
I'm sorry. That was unintelligible. She what?
She wanted me to write one.
Okay. And her name was what again? I have to go look her up.
Like, Dr. Sandra Liebblum.
And how do you spell that last name?
L-E-I-B-L-U-M.
Fabulous. I'm going to go to Amazon.com right after the show.
You will find six or so books.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
Our caller is going to be so happy to have his mother on campus here with him.
Well, she's back in New Jersey right now.
Awesome.
So, anyway, I don't know where she'll be on the show.
Wow. Well, it's definitely fodder for a future show. Well, thank you so much for calling. This has been totally enlightening. And once again, welcome to CMU.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome.
All right, bye.
So, fabulous. Very fascinating. So I actually want to go back, if we can, to a previous point, which you were in the middle of making, which was Judge Learned Hand, or whoever it was, defining pornography. And you said the first thing was appealing to the prurient.
It's a tough word.
Interest. so is this indeed why every time I buy, you know, a work of gay pornography at the video store, there's always this huge disclaimer at the beginning, which is like, you know, this is a masturbatory aid, an educational video designed for people to, like, learn about sex and the privacy of their own homes. I mean, there's this huge disclaimer which, you know, before all of the kinky sexual acts commence, you know, suggests that it's some kind of, you know, educational and entertainment video. Is that to sort of try to avoid this prurient test?
Probably. It's probably trying to get it more into the realm of having some type of literary or artistic value, which makes it not obscene under current law.
And is there any legal leverage to such a disclaimer? I mean, you would think not, right? I mean, just otherwise you would attach a disclaimer to everything you produce. And people do, but like, why do that? What's the point of doing that? I mean, presumably, you know, if this thing ever went to the courts, it would be judged under its own. You know, the content of the video would be judged rather than the presence of this kind of preamble, if you will.
Sure. Well, it's the same thing as, you know, you buy a product and they disclaim every warranty and every liability, or you park your car in a parking lot and they give you a little ticket that says we're not liable for anything that happens here, even if, you know, we let a burglar in who comes and steals everything out of your car.
So in that case, do those things help? Does a company disavowing any liability actually give it any leverage in the case of a lawsuit?
Sometimes it works. A lot of times a court can be persuaded to look beyond that and say, you're negligent, you didn't provide enough security in your parking lot, or this is, look at the contents of this magazine, this is not anything to do with art, this is about sex, obscenity, this is, you know, this appeals only to the prurient interest.
So, and I understand that there was some technical problem, too, with the original CDA, which was used both the words obscene and indecent, and the law is apparently pretty unclear about what indecent means, is there any standard for indecent at all, or is that just kind of... Was that just sloppy wording by the bill's author?
I'd say that it was sloppy wording because the law really gives no definition to that. That was one of the problems with the act. The court said it was overbroad. It tried to screen out too much, and it was impossible to define what was indecent. It's hard enough to define what's obscene and what's not, let alone what's indecent.
I don't think it was. I think that Senator Exon pretty clearly wanted to do away with the indecent. Also, I mean, he had a grand plan of like making the internet safe for 5-year-olds. And
I didn't say that. I said that he. It wasn't that he. I think it was a bad choice of words. I think it was an intentional choice, but I think it was a stupid choice. If your aim is to eliminate everything and you're trying to get around, you fit it within the law, to choose words that are so broad, that was almost an invitation to the ACLU and all those other groups to challenge it.
Well, I think he clearly knew that was going to happen. I mean, he wasn't that dumb to realize that he was going to challenge him. But I think there's another point, though, about this Miller test, which I think it's actually worth going through, because the question is...
Miller test?
Yeah, isn't that what we're talking
right.
about?
Miller versus California was the case that set out the test.
Okay.
And in the Miller test, there's this talk about community standards. And so there's this question, what is community? And we're maybe at the time the Miller test was around, you could think of like the community being the county that the trial was being held at. You know, with the internet, what is the community when it's, you know, basically the entire globe?
Right.
Well, that actually, there's a case that was decided a year or two before Reno called United States versus Thomas. And the Thomases were a husband and wife, a couple in California running a bulletin board service that posted pornographic images. And you could subscribe to it and go to this service on the internet and download photos and pictures. Anyway, this postal inspector in Tennessee heard about it, subscribed to the service, downloaded some of the photos, and then went to the U.S. attorney who prosecuted the Millers in Tennessee for violating obscenity laws. And the question of which community standards apply. Now, if you apply California community standards, my guess is that things are a little more liberal there. But instead, they applied Tennessee community standards, which had much more conservative community standards there. And the Thomases were convicted.
I think, as we were talking about this earlier, I think this is the famous Rusty and Edie's BBS, but why is something so manifestly outrageous like permitted? I mean, these people are in jail right now based on a legal technicality, which is kind of stupid, right? I mean, they were clearly, in some sense, you know, the only person that's ever complained about them was a postal inspector out to entrap them. You know, how is this fair? This doesn't seem like, you know, in my fantasy world where the legal system is just, this seems really, really outrageous.
I don't think obscenity laws have ever been particularly just or sane. I mean, you know, we had, you know, the 19th century, we had Anthony Comstock kind of enforcing the whatever obscenity law he happened to feel like doing. And so Anthony, you know, Comstock was like very concerned about, you know, stopping our children from seeing smut, and because this would be, you know, so bad for them. And then he'd turn around the next second and brag about how many pornographers he had driven to commit suicide. And so, you know, he basically, you know, thought that this obscenity was bad, but some way using the law to drive people to commit suicide was good. I don't know if that completely addresses the question. I think what really addresses the question is the fact that there's always been this class basis for obscenity prosecutions, that basically lower class entertainments have always been much more likely to be attacked for obscenity than more upper middle class entertainments.
I just wanted to point out as kind of a random comment that I have noticed, you know, when I have rented pornography or bought it, the kinds of things that I get mail order, I can buy the same film. You know, if I go to some, like, you know, gay sex shop in San Francisco, I can get one version of the film, but if I buy it mail order from the same company, the same title, I get an edited version of the film that's slightly less kinky. And I think that it's because of this community standards problem. I think the things that they sell over the mail, I mean, I know they won't even mail order to certain states at all. Florida, for example, I think you can't buy porn over the mail. I'm not sure what the states are. I mean, I'm sure, like, the obvious ones, Mississippi, right? I'm sure is in there. But indeed, even the things that I order in liberal Pennsylvania are still kind of sanitized somewhat, and you don't get the kind of fisting scenes or, you know, the golden shower scenes or whatever that you would get if you actually bought the film in person in California. So I just thought I'd share that with our listeners.
The Thomases in that case argued that the community for determining the standard should be the online community.
And so how would that standard be determined? Would it be the average online? Would there be some sort of internet electronic vote?
That's what the court said. They said we can't determine who would be a member of the online community. So we have to use Tennessee, since that's the place that the pictures were shipped to. But I'd question whether anything was sent to Tennessee. I'd argue that the postal inspector electronically went to California, got the photos there, and brought them back to Tennessee.
That's
you know, all in the span of a couple of seconds. But anyway, the Thomases are in jail right now and paying a $2 million fine.
I think that's completely outrageous. Well, so what about other, so what did the Thomases do wrong, or what are other online vendors doing to keep themselves out of jail? I mean, can you...
Well, they were charged with violating a specific statute that prohibited knowingly sending through interstate commerce through an interactive computer service obscene materials.
Well, so, but there are other, my point is, there are other BBSs out there that are still operating, and presumably you can still...
There are so many websites out there that have pornography on them that you can access from anywhere, so how come you have all these websites and Thomases are in jail?
Is it just because these other websites have different kinds of disclaimers, or have we just not had the right kind of Tennessee hyperzealous postal inspector? I mean, are they all vulnerable, or what?
I think a lot of them are. This particular statute dealt with interactive computer services. A passive website might fall outside of the scope of that law, where someone's just posting nude pictures or pictures with sexual content.
But, I mean, these are really big businesses. I mean, sex is... Pornography basically is driving a lot of the technology of the internet itself, or at least it has been for the last 2 years. You know, it's been a real reason for a lot of improvements in internet technology. So,
why is that anyway? I mean, why is the internet so closely tied with pornography?
Well, but pornography drives every business.
I think it's because it's. The internet gets used kind of recreationally, mm-hmm. and so it provides an opportunity for like impulse buying and
right. Pornography. Anonymity is a key factor too, of course.
Right.
You no longer have to go to some smoky movie theater or some kind of slightly seedy 24-hour adult bookstore or whatever. You can just be in the comfort of your own home and masturbating or whatever.
Well, it's not like it's some secret who these people are doing this either. I mean, I saw like an article, I think in Fortune magazine, about one of the big pornographers and how he was such a good businessman. I mean, so it seems like this would be an ideal target for.
Well, that's not just what bothers me. Like, what would happen in the idea, in the alternate United States where people just stopped trying to suppress this, and. I mean, I think it wouldn't be a whole lot different from the world we have now.
That's what I was...
Except there would be slightly fewer people in jail, and, postal inspectors would go back to,
sorting letters.
Right, or,
That was my argument earlier on, that it just really doesn't matter if children see sexual materials. I think that maybe there might be some reason to try to encourage people, like, self-censorship in terms of seeing violence.
What about child pornography? Should that be regulated at all?
I don't think there should be any regulation of pornography. So I think that there is one thing that can be regulated, and that is the production of new child pornography via using real children to do it. And I say it very deliberately in this way, because I don't think that the production of child pornography, which does not involve the use of children to produce it, I think that should be considered to be a fine thing to do.
Yeah, but we've talked about this before, and the key thing that you never address is the fact that seeing child... This can be an inducement. If I see a lot of child pornography, I might...
Well, that's the same argument that gets used against all this stuff, that some way people being allowed to see other scenes of sexuality...
But I believe it in the case of child pornography.
Well, but do you have, unless there's some evidence for this, which I don't think there's. Another thing is about this.
There's a societal interest in preventing children from being victimized.
Right, so, but that's Michael's point. He doesn't want to victimize children. He wants to, like, for example, artificially create using digital, using computer technology, child porn that doesn't actually involve children. So it looks like child porn, but it was made completely artificially. It's kind of like Toy Story, but, you know, maybe Boy Story.
Yeah. I just don't see why there should be any problem with this. You know, that as long as children aren't being, victimized, and there's no problem with these images. And the idea that, like, child pornography is so, you know, uniquely likely to create crimes than any other image, I have to say I reject, unless there's some very strong evidence to the contrary, which I certainly don't know of any.
Well, so I don't know that any evidence in any direction, except that, child molesters are particularly insistent and aggressive in achieving their goals. I mean, so everything that we can do to discourage them.
How is like restricting them from child pornography going to restrict? I mean, it's not gonna like, oh, I don't get to see any child pornography, so I'm no longer a child molester. I don't get the argument here at all.
I think seeing it might induce them to do more of it.
I don't think that's an accurate description of the model of human sexuality. I mean, I know that, like, you know, like gay people have been, you know, variety of ways of, you know, trying to, you know, encourage them to be heterosexual, you know, enticement with images of heterosexuality. I don't think it's made any difference.
Interesting. We have about 30 seconds left, and so, Counselor Saunders, I just have a couple of key questions for you. First, have you ever met anybody famous? I'm thinking, who's that lawyer that failed to defend the Menendez brothers? What's her name? I see her on Court TV all the time.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember her name either.
Or Marcia Clark.
Have you ever met Marcia Clark?
I've never met Marcia Clark. I've met the Chief Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Well, I suppose.
I have a friend who's a law clerk who sits next to Judge Hillary Zobel's law clerk, who's the nanny's judge. Anyway, I just thought I'd show that.
I personally know the Attorney General of Pennsylvania.
Oh,
he's
that's
a neighbor of mine, actually.
Oh my gosh! Wow. That's awesome. We're out of time, so I would like to thank all of our fabulous listeners for listening. I would like to remind our viewers that this is WRCT Pittsburgh, and thank all the pre-keys for calling, and please check the website, http://loveline.wrct.com, also available as sextalk.wrct.com. Thank you, Dr. Michael Zeilin. Thank you, Counselor Kurt Saunders, and good night.